You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Monster House presents.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Hey there. What follows is an audio version of an interview originally recorded as part of our Monster Talk Live streaming series that Karen and I hosted during 2020. As of this posting, we're not currently doing those live shows, but they are archived on YouTube. You can check the show notes for a link to this particular episode. And the live format's definitely something we're going to try to get back to in the future. These episodes do not get the normal editing treatment of a traditional Monster Talk, and because of the variety of issues that happen during live recordings, the audio quality may be wildly varied, and you should assume there will be some not-safe-for-work content, so I'm posting all of these as explicit just in case. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting Monster Talk. Your contributions at patreon.com/monstertalk and your positive reviews on the podcasting platforms and applications that you use to listen help us reach new listeners and spread the important message that monsters can be a great tool to learn critical thinking. We need critical thinking now more than ever. Monster Talk is hosted by me, Blake Smith, and my co-host, Dr. Karen Stolzno. If you enjoy this show, please check out our deep catalog of fascinating interviews with experts about psychology, sociology, anthropology, folklore, religion, and more.
Monster Talk.
All right, we are live on YouTube. All right, welcome to Monster Talk Live. I'm Blake Smith.
Great. And I'm Karen Stolzno. Good evening. Yeah. Good morning. And, depends where you are in the world. Yeah.
Well said. So reminder, if you want to support us, you can find us on patreon.com/monstertalk. Tonight we are joined by Joe Laycock and Natasha Michaels, which I'm saying correctly for the first time in years and years. So that's very exciting.
And who are friends of the show and have been on a number of times.
Yeah. And tonight we're going to be talking about our Lord and Savior, Satan. So that's exciting. So,
Satan.
Which after our most previous episode, our most recent episode was about
our most previous
episode right up to this one was our episode about the documentary We Believe in Dinosaurs. So it's obviously fitting to go right from creationism and evolution into let's talk about the devil. Right.
Train to hell. Yeah.
So welcome, Joe and Natasha.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Yeah. It's good to see you. It's good to see anybody.
Yeah. Tell us about it. Yeah.
So this is Karen's doing. She strong armed me using some blackmail stuff to get me to get on camera. It's really great.
Black magic. Yeah. Yeah. But it was your idea to bring Joe and Natasha on the show.
Blake magic.
Blake magic. Yeah. The very worst kind.
It is. It is terrible. Yep. So Joe, you have a new book out. You want to talk about it?
Sure. Yeah. The new book is called Speak of the Devil.
Ooh, nice.
How the Stank Devil Changing the Way We Talk About Religion from Oxford University Press. It came out in February. We had a release party, and we basically ran out of copies almost immediately.
Oxford is
a university press, and so I don't think that they are used to the kind of demand that there was. Because I said there's the Satanic Temple, which I'll talk about in a second, they want to know what I said about them. And there's hundreds of years of them. And so we'll probably have to do like a second printing or something like this.
That's great.
You know, for people who never heard of the Satanic Temple, I always tell them they're the people that wanted to put a statue of the devil up at the Oklahoma Capitol.
Yeah.
And I always go, oh, those guys. Oh, yeah. Okay. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly the conversation I have with my husband during dinner tonight.
That's right. So this is a book about that group. I've been writing about the Satanic Temple since they tried to put the statue up, which is almost from the beginning in 2013. And I wrote about them for an online magazine called Religion Dispatches. And my editor loved the Satanic Temple. And he said, you know, every time you write about them, we get a lot of hits. And so I kept covering them for years. And I, you know, became fairly familiar with Lucian Greaves, who's one of the founders and sort of the spokesperson. And then eventually I decided this is worth a book. For a lot of reasons, one, to just kind of set the record straight about what this group is and where it came from and how it came to be, but more so because they are kind of changing how Americans think about religion. And this is a big, this is the question in religious studies is what actually is religion? And most people assume, well, it's basically beliefs and practices about God or something that seems a lot like that. And so this is a group that's actively saying, no, you don't have to believe in God to be a religion. And of course, the Supreme Court has said that for years, but most people have never really thought about it. And as a result, as I had a Google News alert for the word satanic while I was researching this book, because I wanted to know what people were saying about this group. And I found conservative Christians who said, I no longer believe in religious freedom. Because if it means that the Satanists get rights, then religious freedom is bad. I don't want us to have that in a society. And then I found
only for them.
I found people who said, well, I used to be an atheist. I never thought I would be a religious person, but now I've joined the Satanic Temple and now I consider myself very religious. So that's very interesting to me, right? That these kinds of changes are coming. And I think it's because this is a group that basically forces a kind of platform by, you know, filing lawsuits and things like this. Creating situations where their arguments have to be heard and listened to. And so that's why I find them interesting from a religious studies perspective. Not that they claim to be Satanists or they wear black or they're spooky or funny, but this the way that they're affecting this word religion.
How much of the book is... Sorry, go ahead, Karen.
Yeah. Just going to ask, so they're one of several... churches of Satan's satanic groups in the country, aren't they? Are they the biggest one in America?
They're probably the biggest one by the numbers. It's very hard to count Satanists for a lot of reasons. this applies to atheists too, right? We don't really know how many atheists there are because in some countries you used to be pressured to identify as an atheist. So for example, there's lots of atheists in China, right? And in, say, the United States, you're pressured to not come out as an atheist. So it's hard to count. Mm-hmm. This all applies double to Satanists.
Because right? They can turn invisible, too. That's a lot.
Well, right. but sort of modern Satanism was founded in 1966 by Anton LaVey in San Francisco. And the official position of the Church of Satan, which he founded, is that we don't count. We don't count how many of us there are. They've at one point kind of implied that there were lots of them, that they were a really big organization. It seemed that there's not that many people who are card-carrying members of the Church of Satan. But they're a non-theistic satanic group, meaning this is for us a kind of psychotherapy. It's catharsis. It's mythology. Mm-hmm. But we don't believe in a real Satan. The Satanic Temple is the same way. The Satanic Temple usually reports their numbers as being, you know, 10,000 or something like that, but that's really just people who are on their mailing list, right? Okay. Some of those are quite serious about it, and some of them are, you know, Christians who want to see what they're up to or all kinds of things. There are other types of contemporary Satanism that are theistic, that actually believe there's really a Satan, or if there's not a real Satan, there is some sort of metaphysical sort of dark force in the universe, because why else would we do all these rituals, right, if there wasn't? And I even did a podcast with a theistic Satanist who said all this stuff with the Satanic Temple is very offensive to us, right? Because this is our God, and they're using it as basically a prop for kind of political theater, right? And
interesting.
Appreciate that. So that's kind of the lay of the land as far as religious Satanism goes.
So Satan can be both metaphor and a literal deity for different groups, I suppose, right? And
that's right. It depends on who you're speaking to. But the overwhelming majority of people who identify as Satanists are non-theistic Satanists. Satan is their favorite fictional character.
Well, and so there's this concept of Luciferian, right? So that I see used, I think I first became aware of it actually through the Heaven's Gate cult. Way before they killed themselves, I had gotten some material, recruiting material from a friend who sent it to me while I was in the Navy. And it all talked about the Luciferians. And it made me think a lot about the sort of story of the Garden of Eden, where you've got the character of the serpent, which has now become associated with Lucifer, although that's not really literally in the text. And there's this idea that the tree that Lucifer is like suggesting they eat is the tree of knowledge, and I guess of knowledge of good and evil, but it is a tree of knowledge. And in a sense, Lucifer is serving as almost a Prometheus character. Give them knowledge, and now they're kicked out of paradise. And there's that whole metaphor around, you know, knowledge can be painful, and knowledge is a terrible thing, and knowledge is in this sense, is the gateway to everything we've accomplished, but at the price of having to leave paradise, the paradise of ignorance. I don't know. So do you run into people who treat Luciferian sort of approaches as a concept where Lucifer is a hero for getting us out of that stupid garden so we can go out and do some stuff? Or is that just me imagining that?
No, absolutely. I mean, as early as probably the second to fourth century, you had Gnostics, right? Gnostic Christians who said, No, the snake was the good guy, right? The being that you call God is like the Matrix, right? Wants us to keep us trapped in this false reality. And the snake was trying to get us out. The snake was like Morpheus or something. And so the Gnostics...
And the apple's a red pill. Come on, man. It's all right there in the text. Right?
So that kind of different interpretation is very old. But sort of the modern roots of religious Satanism go to... the Romantics of the 19th century.
Not the band.
Right. Not the band. But people like Lord Byron and Blake and people like this.
Not me, but yeah.
Not you, yeah. Unless you're the immortal or something like this. Right. But people who were sort of saw Satan as the good guy, as being sort of a tragic character. And this dovetailed with critiques of monarchy as a system of government, critiques of the church, attitudes that science should triumph over dogma and things like this. And these are basically all the same things that get tied up for modern Satanists, right? Modern Satanists. Well, Satan is a symbol of all these progressive enlightenment ideas, and that's why he's our favorite fictional character.
So with the Satanic Temple, in your book, you write about a number of stunts that they've pulled. So wanting to set up the satanic statues and things like that. And some of the other things you talk about are like satanic nativity scenes, wanting to set those up and to institute satanic prayers and after-school Satan. I'm very intrigued by what after-school Satan is.
Right. So I mean, a big part of their kind of public face is doing these stunts basically designed to prove a very simple point, which is why do you let Christians have this access to a government platform and government resources? You wouldn't want a minority religion to have the same access. And you especially wouldn't want Satanists to have the same access. So when they tried to put a Ten Commandments monument in Oklahoma, which, by the way, that simply violated the Oklahoma State Constitution. And it was actually a Baptist pastor who sued and said this is bad for both Christianity and for the state. So the Satanic Temple's proposal of, well, we want a statue of the devil up as well, that didn't have any direct effect on the Ten Commandments monument being removed, But there were people who said, well, let's just rewrite the state constitution so that we can put Christian symbols everywhere. And I did find conversations where people said, well, what about those Satan guys? Aren't they going to come back if we rewrite the constitution? So they did kind of make a point. And they've done this with lots of other things. A big campaign that they did was called After School Satan. This is a response to a group called the Good News Club. The Good News Club sets up after school programs in public schools all over America and does basically Sunday school. Kristen Stewart wrote a book on the Good News Club. And in that book, she found that there were cases where people said, you know, there's a church across the street. Could you take the students across the street and do Sunday school there after school? And supposedly the Good News Club said, no, we have to do it in the public school because we want kind of the authority of the school to be behind our evangelizing. And there was a case where a school tried to sue and get rid of them, and they lost the case. They said, you have to let everybody in. Well, if you have to let everybody in, that means you have to let in the Satanists. So the Satanists did this, and they created a complete curriculum, and they tapped Camp Quest, which is a humanist summer camp sort of program. So they had a real curriculum, and it was things like learning about nature and learning about, I don't know, things like...
Baleen.
What was it?
Baleen.
What's Baleen?
Baleen. Bullying, like they had like looking at things that like how not to bully or how to
bullying.
Yeah, yeah,
I thought you were
right.
Saying she's pronouncing bowling the weirdest I've ever heard it.
No, I understood what you meant.
Yeah, but like, you know, what to do when you're
bullying. No, you're right. Yeah, bullying.
What will the kids do to you, Blake?
You know, I'm very familiar with bullying, so I assure you.
And that seems, all of those kinds of things seem to be a lot more real world and useful.
Right. Yes. It was not. Well, that's the thing, is people were saying, well, this isn't real. The Good News Club is doing, they have a real curriculum, and this is just trying to scare people. If you look into what the After School Satan Club was, they actually did have an entire school year's worth of curriculum with lesson plans and modules and things like that. The reason that program was not successful ultimately was because their insurer said, we don't want to insure you. We didn't realize this was a satanic thing. Mm-hmm. Which I don't actually think that's the case.
Really? Yeah.
We never really did for good reason. You need a ton of insurance to do something like this. So that kind of shut the program down. I know people who were involved, and they said, we're going to do it again. It's on hold, but we're going to make it happen.
I'm trying to figure out what the actuarian tables are related to the Satan.
Yeah.
And one of the things, you know, I accompany Joe on a lot of his field work, just because I'll get roped into anything for like a beer and promise of a pizza at the end of it. And
fair enough.
That really
there are worse bases of marriage.
My husband does the same thing. We both tag along to whatever we're doing.
That's nice. That's very nice.
So. But one of the things that's really remarkable is, you know, on one hand, it does seem like this is like kind of all being done for publicity. But I think the After School Satan program is a great example that, you know, for the people that are involved with the Satanic Temple, like this is really meaningful to them. And there's this one theologian, Paul Tillich, who talks about religion as being basically your ultimate concern, and that it doesn't have to be God. It can be something else. And for these people, like this Satanism as like kind of a freeing philosophy was their ultimate concern. And you know, these people were not ingenuine and were not just trying to like, you know, shock everyone. They really, this was very deeply, obviously very deeply held to them.
So what you don't understand about the Satanic Temple is the media only reports on these big public kind of stunts, but there are chapters all over America, and those chapters meet regularly. They have book clubs. I got to go to a satanic barbecue here in Austin. When Christians get together and do these things, they call it fellowship. If you only know about these big stunts, you might well assume, well, this is not real, right? This is just sort of the kind of trolling. If you actually look at all the things that this group does that are not reported on or the public's not invited to, including religious rituals, they do satanic rituals that are just for them. It looks less like a prank and more like a serious religion.
In a satanic barbecue, do they use like a mustard based barbecue sauce for the babies, or like a tomato based barbecue sauce for the babies?
Eat babies. It's like,
there were other people in the park, and I don't think anyone knew that this was a group of Satanists. I mean, there were more black t-shirts probably than more. Other than that, it looked like any other group that you would see in the park. One of them had a corgi. They brought their kids. They were playing kickball. I think someone may have been playing some Slipknot or something. That might have been a clue. But generally, a satanic barbecue looks like anybody else's barbecue.
I was actually literally wondering about potlucks, if that was like part of things. So I just
absolutely is,
because I mean, for me personally, as much as you know, I came from a very religious background. And I remember the joys of being involved in church. It just began to conflict with my personal beliefs, but I still miss the camaraderie and I miss the potlucks. And so, I don't know if I'm ready to take up metaphorical Satanism to get that in my life, but I do love a potluck.
I think that's a question. Do you think that they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot, in the feet?
In the hoof.
In the hoofs. With this kind of facade, because as you say, a lot of this is kind of, you know, camaraderie and humanism, really, skepticism, atheism. And do you think that they'd be more successful if they didn't have this kind of this front, this label, this kind of name, and which a lot of people misinterpret as, oh, they're just out to harass us or mock us, or that they truly do believe in Satan? Do you think they'd have more impact if they didn't use that title?
Yeah, I mean, this definitely occurred to me, because, you know, groups like LifeSite News, which is a Catholic pro-life news outlet, seems to love the Satanic Temple. They report on them more than anybody else, because they can say, look, this is what we've been saying for years. Anyone who believes in legal abortion is a Satanist, right? And is the enemy of all humanity and hates God. And here's a smoking gun, right? Look at these people. I got to talk to their lawyer who represented their reproductive rights case in Missouri. The lawyer, interestingly, is a Presbyterian elder and teaches Sunday school, but he objected to Missouri's laws as a Christian. But he did tell them, guys, why don't you call yourselves the Free Thinkers Club or something like that, right? This isn't going to sound well if we go in there and you guys are Satanists. I've talked to the Satanic Temple, though, and they say, first of all, we really are Satanists. We didn't pick this out of a hat or something like that. Satan actually means something to us. They also have said, you know, we think that our opponents are so hysterical that it really doesn't matter whether we actually are Satanists or not. These are people who think Monster Energy drink is satanic, right? And the Procter & Gamble logo is satanic.
Ooh, that's a deep cut from way back. Yeah.
but I do have a chapter about that in the book, and sort of how they are taking this discourse of evil and popular imaginations of what evil is and trying to sort of flip it, right? Because a big part of what they do is they do charity work. And it's like, look, we're the bad guys. If we're doing more charity work than the Christians, we're doing more to feed the homeless. You know, what does that say about them? And so it's a strategy. It's a risky strategy, though, because you always run the risk of just sort of reinforcing this idea that this evil conspiracy is out there.
Yeah, certainly good publicity to use such an inflammatory name.
I'm so old, I remember the Procter & Gamble stuff from Facts Lore.
I remember
lore.
It too.
Facts Lore, though. I mean, it's like, like, well, we had mimeographed copies at our church. That's real. So, it's
like, one of the most interesting things that Joe uncovered was that there were some people who told the Satanic Temple, you're not good Satanists, because they weren't sufficiently evil, or because
unholier than thou. I get it. Yeah.
And, you know,
you got to be immoral.
Taken aback by, like, this, you know, I don't know who decides who is Satan, like who's an appropriate or correct Satanist.
But yeah, we are always trying to balance, you know, we are nice, reasonable people, and you shouldn't want us in your public schools because we're Satanists. And so it's this kind of constant back and forth of, are you guys really Satanists? Or not. So when they set up their headquarters in Salem, for example, Malcolm Jerry, one of the co-founders, wanted to hold an ice cream social, a satanic ice cream social, and invite the mayor of Salem and all this. And there were people who were like, really, ice cream socials? That's what we should be doing as Satanists? That tension, I think, is unavoidable, and it's constantly being...
Depends on the flavors.
Yeah. I mean, you don't get ice cream in hell based on the things I've read. So, yeah. Get it now. Something to remember for later. So, yeah.
I was going to just ask about the costumes. Do the Satanic Temple followers, do they get into the costumes like some of the other groups or not really? The psychodrama and...
Yeah, I think for some people that is a big appeal, right? As you get to sort of dress how you want to dress. I went to a political rally they did in Arkansas in 2018, and you know, people have called them things like the Hot Topic Army, right? It was a lot of black. We have a friend here who headed the San Marcos chapter of the Satanic Temple. He's a Renaissance Festival jouster. And he showed up in Arkansas in his plate mail with like this sort of satanic version of like a Knights Templar standard and things like this. I've also talked to Malcolm Jerry, who does go these things and is very inconspicuous, and said, when I want to go to a satanic event, I wear a suit because I think suits are the most evil. All evil people wear suits. So there's sort of room to express yourself.
With a tie or without?
I think with a tie. Yeah, I don't know.
With a tie. Yeah.
Where's he? Where's he?
He's in Salem. Yeah.
Salem. Okay. Yeah. Because if it was Texas, it'd be a bolo, right?
I mean. Yeah, that's right.
Come on. Yeah. Good point. Yeah.
I've seen Texas. Other parts of the country. Yeah, we have offices.
Cravat.
Yeah, and cowboy boots, blue jeans, an Oxford shirt, and a bolo, and you're Texas business casual. So. Yeah. So that's so funny. So metaphorically, so you've got the Satanic Temple and you have the Church of Satan. Do they consider themselves allies or
not? Quite the opposite.
Yeah, that's kind of the impression I got. Okay.
Yeah. So they've been compared to this. The situation has been compared to the Protestant Reformation in the sense that you have two sects where before there was only one, each claiming why the other one is a false expression of this religion, right? And only we are the true Satanists, and you guys either have become corrupt or kind of you have gone rogue and you don't really understand what this was ever really about. But if you look at, say, Twitter, you will see constant accusations back and forth between the Satanic Temple and the Church of Satan. The Church of Satan has even coached some of the conservative Christians in lawsuits about, you know, these are the arguments you should raise to try to discredit the Satanic Temple in court.
Wow,
it's pretty pretty brutal at this point. So, yeah, no love lost.
Is there any like anybody that transcends those boundaries? Like, is Jane Mansfield appreciated by both, or like?
That's the other thing. So this I mentioned Anton LaVey earlier. If you go to Salem and you visit the Satanic Temple headquarters, they have a room called the Panic Room, as in Satanic Panic.
Okay.
And this whole library of books on Satanism, there's not a single book there by Anton LaVey.
What have you done for me, LaVeyly? Exactly.
So LaVey is noticeably absent. However, when I talk to different chapters around the country of the Satanic Temple, a lot of them read LaVey in their book clubs and things like this. And even if they didn't, a lot of them said, well, of course, when I was 16, I bought the Satanic Bible by Anton LaVey and I used it to scare my neighbors or whatever. So LaVey was definitely an influence on this group. But a lot of LaVey's ideas in the Satanic Bible are seen by modern Satanists as being homophobic and misogynistic. LaVey was a big fan of Ayn Rand and sort of brutal libertarianism. The Satanic Temple is pretty progressive socially. So even the ones who admire LaVey would say there are places where I just can't get together with him on these big issues.
Yeah. Well, I have to add here that I've just got a very short anecdote where my husband actually met him, Anton LaVey, when my husband was a young boy. His parents owned a little I guess, general store in Northern California, just out in a rural area. And he came into the store. I think he was wanting a fishing license or something. And so Matt's mother was dealing with him, and he was a real asshole. He was just poking her and prodding her and being really insulting and abusive and just trying to set her off. And he apparently bought an ice cream and, oh no, didn't buy it, just stole an ice cream and stood there and just ate it. And was
so he's ice cream antisocial. And, that's what you're saying.
yes. Therein lies the difference. But apparently he was just really, really nasty. And Matt's mum was very upset. And Matt thought, cool. This guy's cool. It's pissing off my mum.
If you read LeVay's writings, right, he would say, at least I'm not a hypocrite, right? I never claimed to be this nice person, right?
You know, yeah, he was.
Take you seriously.
Yep.
You'll have to ask Matt. Anton LeVay wrote an essay against bathing with the argument that you should never take a bath because it was deceptive to not let your natural pheromones accumulate on your body. And
Okay. So we want to know if that's true.
I want to know, did he smell? Like, was he a smell?
I'm going to text him right now. I want to know. Let's get this live.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or, say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are experimenting with that right now.
Oh, he's standing right. He was stinky.
He was stinky. That's funny.
Matt just came to the door and was like,
"He wasn't a hypocrite."
There you go.
He said you shouldn't.
Well, he would say things sometimes that were clearly just jokes to kind of get a rise out of people. But biographers of LeVay have speculated that he probably smelled pretty terrible near the end of his life.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Forget about the baptismal symbology. I remember reading a story one time where, like, there was a whole thing about do you offend, and it was an advertisement for antiperspirant. I think it might have been Ogden Nash story, and I kept thinking about do you offend, and it was like an ad for antiperspirant. But yeah, I mean, obviously, naturally, people used to stink really badly, and now we don't have to. So it's a choice. It's a choice.
In some parts of California, it's just culturally.
Yeah. Accepted. I mean, you know, who needs a bath when you've got patchouli? So, yeah.
Yeah.
we should talk, Natasha, since you guys are a religious studies power couple. Like, what are you up to, Natasha? So
I've been teaching online like a lot of other academics. One of the big things I'm up to is I have been working on founding a journal out of our monster seminar that we had at Texas State, I think about a year ago at this point. So positive. Blake was there. It was great. And there was so much energy that we actually found a journal, the Journal of Gods and Monsters. It's an online open access journal. Anyone can read it and anyone can submit. So we are working on getting our first issue out. It is double blind peer reviewed, and that is always a big delay in getting you know research published, but it does ensure that the research is quite good.
And when do you think the first issue will come out?
We're hoping I would anticipate maybe in late June or July.
Soon.
Yeah, quite soon. And we've been working really closely with, we're quite fortunate here at Texas State University that our philosophy department tech person, our kind of IT specialist, is also really into monsters. So shout out to Andrew Boyd.
Nice.
He's been really kind of passionate about helping us get this thing up and running and helping us kind of work through the kinks of peer review. And we made a little brand and everything, which, you know, is kind of a upstart journal, was just me with Microsoft Paint trying to make something that looked professional. But I think it turned out really great.
Great.
Outstanding.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, when we post this online, we can put some links in the show notes.
That'd be wonderful. Yes. Anyone out there that has articles they want to submit, we'd love to see them. So like I said, our first special issue is going to be on monsters and boundaries and kind of boundary crossing. And then we are also kind of talking about maybe doing a special issue at some point in the future on female monsters in Asia, because there's a lot of really cool female figures in kind of Asian religious traditions that are terrifying and monstrous. Of course, you know, what is a monster can always come up in those kinds of conversations.
It's interesting. The what is a monster is much like the what is a religion question.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And, you know, I presented about a year ago at a conference in Russia talking about the king of the Buddhist underworld, King Yama, as a monster. And a lot of the criticisms were like, well, that's a Western term. And I do think, though, that as a term, it has value to think about religious figures as monstrous, as monsters, and what can be gained from that. Because they are terrifying. So like, and they're intended to be terrifying for religious practitioners.
Yeah.
We've been talking a lot about, we've been talking a lot about the whole process of where scary monsters are being made into sort of, pop culture commodities,
which Ford and
defanged, declawed. I've been calling it the gentrification, which I'm pretty excited about.
Television ads and comedy.
Exactly.
Well, and in teaching online, I've been trying to make sure my students are watching the videos, the kind of Zoom lectures that I put up. And so I've been hiding Easter eggs in them where I will sometimes ask them to send me a picture that tells me what students have been watching so far. And for one video, Easter egg was a little stuffed animal of Cthulhu that I held up and said, you know, I am Cthulhu, the Dark Lord of the Underworld, you know, or Dark Lord, that's the Underworld, the Elder God under the sea. Please send me. If you send a picture of me to Dr. Michaels, I'll put a good word in for you and you might get a point of extra credit. And all above the board, every photo was every like picture I got from like the one third of the students that sent me photos were cute Cthulhus. Well, it was like cute, or there were a couple of sexy Cthulhus, which made me feel very weird.
Well, what makes it sexy?
It was like
this wow.
Japanese girl outfit, and I didn't know what to do with that one. A lot of them were really cute Cthulhu, but like you'd be on a shirt or something. So totally that, you said the gentrification, the defanging them.
Yes, was that the hentai come in, the hentai to go out? Nobody can explain it.
So another course that you've been teaching is a class on hell. I'm very interested in that. Can you tell us a bit about your class?
Yeah.
Sure. So this is a seminar. I've taught it now four times actually now at Texas State University.
Okay.
I've been trying to get a religious studies major at Texas State University, and it just went forward. So we've been able to accept students in the fall. But as part of that, they wanted really high interest courses and courses that didn't require a lot of specific knowledge coming into them, so that like could be taken as an elective by almost anyone. And so through this, I developed a course on kind of cross-cultural comparative ideas of hell, because this is one of my big research interests. And it's something that I find really very, very interesting. And so the course kind of goes roughly chronological it starts with kind of a conversation about what is hell. And that's kind of the overarching question that myself and the students try to ask is, is hell just of a concept in Abrahamic religious traditions? Can we say that the Buddhist things that we think of as hells, are they really hell, or are they not? Is it inappropriate? Like, are we just applying Western terms to describe something that's very, very different? And so that's sort of the overarching question. But we start with the Greeks, with the Aeneid, and with the Zoroastrians, this great text called the Book of Art Awiroff. You can find it for free online. And it is I cannot think of an earlier journey to hell story where someone goes to hell, sees all the punishments. And so we start there, and then we end up with hell in the movies and talking about kind of Hellraiser. And we do a comparative of things like Hellraiser, I said, and Ted and,
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Yeah.
Raise a glass to Max von Sydow. So yeah.
So it's a really fun course, and it's cool because we get a lot of cultures, and kind of students get to be really creative. Two of my favorite texts that we talk about in this course, actually have them here. One is this book, Travels in the Netherworld. I'm going to try to hold it up. This is a great book about kind of Tibetan Buddhist ideas of hell. There's this thing in Tibetan Buddhism called a Dalok, who is a person who dies, goes to hell, sees all the horrors, and then either gets sent back, or sometimes Yama's like, oh, you just had the same name as someone we were going to kill.
dead yet. Bureaucracy is a kind of hell.
It is. Yeah. And this is a great book because it explains it all like in really kind of cool layman's terms, because like I said, these students are expected to not have any kind of prior knowledge. So there's lots of great kind of grisly detail, you know, rivers of fat floating down and all sorts of the kinds of things you want in hell literature. Other time that we also talk about, and this is one that I've just done for the first time this semester, I don't have a PDF of it, is A Round Trip to Hell in a Flying Saucer by Cecil Nichol. This text came to my attention through Gabe McKee, who's the librarian for collections and service at the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World at New York University. But he also, in addition to doing that, has this interest in kind of UFO literature. And
crossover. So
1953 is when it was written. And it is, if you can find a copy of this, it is the most bizarre text because it is not what you think it is. It's not the kind of like, was the alien intrusion movie that Joe and I, we've been on here before talking about, where like aliens are actually demons. It's not that at all. It is something else entirely. And it is written by an auto mechanic who seems to have no evidence of writing anything before. It's great.
Wow. Awesome. Cool title.
Compare it to is the movie Phantasm.
Oh, really?
Yeah, wow. In the sense that, it's actually more disturbing than kind of, oh, all the aliens are really demons, right? I mean, one interpretation of this text is what we think of as hell is this bizarre exploitation of our labor by forces we can never understand. And you do wonder reading it, am I reading the writings of a schizophrenic person? You know, what exactly is this text? Is it a hoax?
Because there are these lots of really interesting scenes because the author is an auto mechanic where the aliens who maybe are angels are just invisible in his auto mechanic shop while people walk in and are just there for weeks. And he describes it and there's no explanation for why they're doing that. There's no explanation for what's happening. It's really fascinating. It's a cool text.
It sounds a lot like Richard Shaver and his welding entry into the Shaver Mysteries and the Darrow and all that stuff. Do you dive straight into hell, or do you start off with like some explanatory purgatory?
Well, the Greek underworld, which we're like, is this a hell? Because a lot of people say, well, that's our first story about hell, but no one's being tortured. There's no kind of head honcho being like, these are your punishments. It's just boring blah forever, and it's like, is this really hell? Because when we get definitions of what hell is on the first day, everyone's like, would this be torture, and there's a devil, and like none of that is really
disappointing.
It you think you're going to hell, but it seems kind of Persephone. Okay.
I've got to interject here. I haven't been watching the chat. Is there a chat? Have you had any questions? I haven't been following it tonight, so.
Sorry. I've been sort of seeing, apparently I'm making people drink when I do puns. That's terrible.
You've made me drink for years. But yeah, usually we have some questions come through for the guests, and so I haven't been watching it. And I know we've got a lot of people out there who are big
fans. I think they're having a fun time. It's like people are talking about drinking and
they're drinking. Yeah. Shout out to Meridian Hive Mead from Austin, Texas.
Mead.
Salute. Oh,
okay. That carbonated mead. It's
very nice.
Nice.
Free.
Gluten-free.
Gluten-free. Wow. Yeah. I you know, Twizzlers, gluten-free. Sorry.
Lots of things are surprisingly gluten-free. But Joe, just a question about the Satanic Temple. Do they have a position on hell at all?
They're for it.
You can read their seven tenets, and they basically say, you know, we only believe in things that can be determined by science, by, you know, mm-hmm. the current findings of science. So I think most of them would say, you know, we assume that there's no afterlife. I talked to them about, you know, well, what if somebody was really into everything you guys do, but just happened to believe in God or happened to believe in the afterlife? And they said, well, we're not, you know, we don't think it's our place to sort of kick people out. We don't have a kind of satanic inquisition or something like that. Of course, they're welcome, but this is our kind of position statement. So it, as far as metaphysics go, they assume that none of it is real because there's no evidence for it.
Sure. Yeah.
One of the interesting things with teaching this hell class is it really kind of throws in relief how, you know, something that educators don't talk about is how every group of students is very different. And when you walk into the classroom kind of makes this energy and you don't know what energy you're going to get. And I find that with the hell class, because it's on something that is in some ways so personal and so gripping, but also kind of funny a little bit, because a lot of these hell texts, like, you know that the author was kind of trying to be like, look, she's getting her boobs ripped in half. Boobies. I said boobies. You know, that the students are really different. And so I've had some classes where they walked in and be like, well, hell is dumb. This is all dumb. Religion is dumb. We're all dumb. And so I had to kind of push back and be like, what is actually happening here for these people? And then other times I have classes where everyone is very convinced hell is real and it's just taking everything at face value. And it's like, oh, this person went to hell. And I'm like, well, we have two people that went to hell, one that saw Yama as the, you know, Lord of the Underworld and sent some people on to be reincarnated, and one that saw the devil as a prisoner, and others that saw the devil as a prince. Like, so we have three things that cannot be true. This particular class that I've been working with online due to the corona has been really interesting, because a lot of students didn't know what the class was when they signed up. And so it's sort of fun. I'm excited for them to learn, like, oh, we're talking about this all semester. So I thought it was going to be like a couple of weeks.
Because we have a standard seminar called Myth and Cosmology. And some students thought you learned about the stars or something because it said cosmology.
Cosmology.
Wow. I learned about the differences between foundation and base.
Right. But it was like
that was a joke just for my wife. Okay, so do you guys talk about the sort of metatextual issues? So, for example, I'm thinking here in terms of how Dante and Milton's texts have influenced Christian thought. Like, how much of what our concepts of the afterlife are have to do with these sort of fictional things that were never intended to be scriptural, but have like influenced the way people believe?
Definitely. And that's what we end up talking about when we talk about hell, the movies, is how our ideas of what hell is are way more influenced by pop culture things like Milton and Dante, or like Hellraiser, or, you know, kind of popular movies that we have today, than they really ever are by scriptural texts. And you go in the kind of Christian Bible, one of the kind of hard things with the Christian Bible is that the words that get translated as hell were, you know, it's a translation. These were never really intended to be hell. As far as we can understand, and Bart Ehrman has a great book out on this right now.
What, really? I didn't know he had a new one out. What's it about?
It's called about kind of is hell and heaven and the Bible. And his conclusion is kind of spoiler alert. No, Jesus was the Second Temple Jew. And it seems like they believed, as best we can tell, is that Second Temple Jews believed you die. And when the Messiah came back, if you were good, you would get bodily resurrected, but only if your body existed. If you were bad, a criminal or someone that the Messiah didn't like, they just threw your body into this giant burning trash heap called Gehenna. But as Christianity spread outside of kind of Israel and outside this little area, people had never seen Gehenna. And so they read, oh, your body gets tossed into the fires of Gehenna. Well, there must be some place where you're tortured. And then eventually the Greeks got involved and they had totally different ideas about the underworld.
You keep talking about Hellraiser. And so I'm going to do my look, I'm Butterball. Okay, that's it. That was my LARP. I'm a big fan. I can't do Pinhead because, you know.
And I will also talk about, there's a great film from the 80s in Japan called Jikoku, which is a Japanese detective who dies and goes to a Buddhist underworld of hell. And they were just starting to experiment with like colors and like using kind of psychedelic colors. That's really cool in there.
Oh, yes. By the way, so one of our listeners, yes, Thelonious, but Milton is pop culture back then.
And I have to constantly remind students, Dante is not scripture.
Right. Dante's not scripture. Also pop culture. Yeah. And what a whiny dude. My God. He's like,
I have a good friend who's a scholar of Dante. And if she ever sees this, she will disown me. I think Dante's overrated. My hot take. I do not like Dante. So
that's funny. Yeah. He peaked a long time ago. So
So what's that other?
I was going to say the best part about the Inferno is when, like, in the second, Dante's descending to hell, and then he meets all these great poets, Homer and Virgil, all these great poets, and they like give him a crown of leaves and say, "You are among us." And I'm like, "Ah, Dante,
come on, right?" It's
like the Mary Sue.
No.
Yeah. Okay, that's pretty funny. Sorry. Dante. So,
we're into our last 10 minutes of the show. The show's going really quickly. But I just want to know what other projects you guys are working on, because, Joe, haven't you got something coming out about exorcisms?
Sure. So Penguin contacted me, which is a huge deal, because I've written several books for academic presses, but normally, so again, there was something like Penguin, you need to hire an agent and all this sort of stuff. And they do a series called, which has been featured on Monster Talk, is the Penguin Book of fill in the blank. So Penguin Book of the Undead, Penguin Book of Witches, Penguin Book of Hell. And these sell very well. And I asked if I could do a Penguin Book of Exorcisms. And that has been put together, and we're going to have that out hopefully by Halloween 2020. Wow. But that's going to have some classic texts on exorcism from the Western tradition, but also from Hinduism, Buddhism, from Haitian voodoo. I even found an account of an exorcism from an Indian reservation up in Washington State, and also some texts that were pretty much lost. And another text that I had to go into archives to find. Another thing I'm really excited about is the Indiana Demon House, which was covered a long time ago. I found the original letter requesting a bishop to approve that exorcism. And the priest who did the exorcism gave me permission to publish it in the book. So from someone who
knows
church history, because all Catholic exorcisms are supposed to have approval from a bishop. So this paper trail must exist, but it's never been available to the public before to look at, right? How do you actually convince your bishop this case is serious enough? You should give me permission to do this. The danger outweighs any potential embarrassment, for example, to the church. I'm pretty pleased with how it came out. I think it's going to be a good read when it's published.
That's cool. Great. Is it just put together by you, or do you have other contributors?
It's me with lots of help, right? So yeah. One thing I'm telling people is I could not have done this project without librarians, right? Without professional librarians who maintain archives and special collections, this simply would have been impossible. And there were lots of people that I tapped for translations of other languages or cultural context, if it's a religion or a tradition I'm not very familiar with. I had one friend who was a gymnast, and I said, this account says this nun was levitating on everything but one elbow. You're a gymnast, could you do that? And she's like, well, for how long? Probably. You know? So all kinds of experts were involved.
And a gymnast can also give you feedback on X4 size. So that's good.
That's right. Yes. So.
Just a few more minutes, guys, hanging in.
We're going to make it.
That's a really exciting project. That's really cool that you were invited to do that. Because I was thinking, oh, I'm going to have to hit him up for his contact at Penguin.
That's nice. That's,
yeah.
Well, the other thing that we should mention is we are doing an edited volume from the conference, from the Gods and Monsters conference, and that's coming out from mm-hmm. Lexington Books. And so currently I am wrangling all of our scholars and authors into getting me their drafts, but that will be forthcoming.
Someone in this interview right now.
Blake Smith guy.
He's a little late to submit.
I'm thinking about sympathizing with demons because, like me in high school, they're all outcasts. So
your thing's IT. Yeah, his background is in academia. It's a different world. Scary world.
Oh wow! I was looking to see if there's any other. Everybody's talking about what they're drinking and ragging me for making puns.
Yeah, that's, like, and you're surprised. It's
a typical episode. So.
Yeah, just normal.
Well, what else? I mean, is there anything else going on you guys are working on? Or
I think that's enough, isn't it?
No, no, we have 5 minutes to kill, Karen. We need to squeeze a little more out. Are you guys doing any role playing in this? I mean, you know.
We had a D&D campaign organized that we were doing.
Before the quarantine.
Before the quarantine. Okay. Yeah. So it's hard to keep up.
So we're hoping to get back to that.
Yeah.
So I've been working on my research, like I said, on Buddhist hells, and on this particular episode of a Tibetan epic where the hero descends to hell named King Gesar. And doing a lot of thinking about kind of stories. And I think this idea of popular culture and like Dante and Milton were popular culture is totally germane to this. And this idea that there are certain stories that influence people's religious ideas outside of the kind of religious institutions. Kind of trying to pin that down in Tibet where it can be hard sometimes to pin anything down.
Well, this is the Tibetan version of what we were just talking about, right? What is religious pop culture?
Yes.
And what is the canon? And how do these things influence the way people see the world?
Yeah. So, because when I've done research in Tibet, one thing that always strikes me is that Tibetans don't want to talk about, I mean, they're Buddhists, but they don't want to talk about like these sutras or these tantras. They don't want to talk about these kinds of canonical scriptures. What they want to talk about is that one time King Gesar went to hell and then like battled a bunch of demons. Wasn't that really cool? So Buddhism's so powerful because King Gesar did that. And I think there's something really important there. So I'm working on putting that into words.
Uh-huh. Very cool.
Very briefly talk about how Gesar defeated the Third Reich.
Yes. Yes.
Very briefly.
It's really helpful.
Right quick, like.
Yeah.
So King Gesar is this hero. And there was a Tibetan Lama a Tibetan bard who heard about World War II after the fact and heard about how terrible it was and said, well, King Gesar could have taken on the Third Reich. And so wrote this text. It's called The Imaginative Fantasy of King Gesar Defeating the Nazi of Germany. And it's about King Gesar defeating the Nazis of Germany. And it's, you know, it's not claimed to be history. It's an imaginative fantasy and it's a great text. And so that's what I want to translate and turn it into a graphic novel. If I can just find time to translate and find a good artist.
Fantastic. Wow. I mean, you know, I think it's funny. I think it was DC. I might be, this is where I get all the comics fans mad at me, but I think it was DC that took on the Legend of the Spear of Destiny as being the reason why the superheroes couldn't actually intervene in World War II. I mean, maybe it was Marvel though, because I think DC had, sort of Wonder Woman was kind of involved in fighting Nazis. Captain America was fighting Nazis. Must have been Captain America's. You know what? I should never talk about comics because it's worse than talking about religion. It's worse. You get people more mad at you.
And this could go on for a long time as well.
Yeah, yeah. But no, I remember the Spear of Destiny being used by one of the big two as being a reason why there was an intervention. I have to look that up. But I've always been I've been a long time fascinated with that, the way those sort of legends sort of let you do post rationalization for why things turned out the way they did. So it's really interesting. Well, Karen, since we're talking about books, yours is almost done, isn't it? Because I know you've been working like a dog trying to finish it up, right?
Yeah, I'm just doing the final proof now and fixing all of the errors that the copy editor inserted.
Oh. Nice.
It's at that point. But so On the Offensive, Prejudice in Language, Past and Present. So that's coming out in about October. And I'm very jealous of Joe for putting out two books this year before I can even get one out. So.
Well, it says I got none. Okay, but I'm working.
you're on it. I'm on it.
So I have made a lot of coffee and food for my kids and done other things. So when I don't have that book when I want it done, I know
I think we've all got less time than we thought we would have during this quarantine. Yeah.
So, I thought by now for sure I would have won the lottery. So, yeah, I don't know what happened. So, well, Natasha, Joe, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Always great to talk with you. A lot of fun.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'll get that back to you real soon. I've got to finish reading Ellis. So. All right. I'm going to end this live stream. All right. Goodbye, everybody. Thanks.
Bye, everyone. Again. Thanks for joining us.
Follow us on Patreon, patreon.com/monstertalk.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to a podcast version of Monster Talk Live, a special feature that we recorded during 2020. Links to the video version of these episodes are in the show notes. Please like and subscribe to our YouTube channel, and we'll work to continue to provide good content there, including more streaming events in the future. Monster Talk is a listener-supported program, and your subscription at patreon.com/monstertalk sustains us during these difficult times. Thank you for your support and for your positive reviews. I'm Blake Smith, and along with my co-host Karen Stolzno, we ask you to join us in being the voice of reason and science in a world that's perilous with nonsense, superstition, and dangerous misinformation. Shine your lights, everyone. Even a flickering candle can be seen for miles in the darkness. And together, we are stronger. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you so much for listening.